From the Rhodes Center for International Finance and Economics at Brown University, this is the Rhodes Center podcast. I'm the director of the center and your host, Mark Blythe. What is the role of a university in a democratic society? What responsibilities do universities have to foster the public good, and what responsibilities do the public have to support centers of education and research? These have become some of the most fraught and pressing questions in our current moment, but of course they're also timeless questions, one certainly as old as the Republic itself. This is why I was so curious to talk with Kevin McLaughlin and Karen Wolf, two scholars at Brown who think deeply about just these types of issues. They're also the co-chairs of Brown 2026, an initiative marking the 250th anniversary of the United States, which, among other things, explores the past and future role of universities in a democratic society. Kevin is a literary scholar and director of the John Nicholas Brown Center for Advanced Study at Brown. Karen is a historian and director and librarian of the John Carter Brown Library. Here's our conversation. Karen and Kevin, welcome to the Rhodes Center podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So this is a little bit of an unusual one. I mean, usually the way that this podcast works is we have someone at Brown coming in to give a talk, present research, and then we pull them in and we talk about it. But this is about a project at Brown, Brown 2026. So what is it and what are you trying to do with it?
Well, I'll start first. Thanks very much for inviting us. It's really a pleasure to be here. I listen to your podcast all the time. It's great.
Aww.
So the Brown 2026 initiative is a presidential initiative supported by Christina Paxson. And Karen and I are the co-chairs of a steering committee that was formed about a year and a half ago now to mark the 250th anniversary of American independence. The reason we called it Brown 2026 is to signal that this is a forward-looking initiative in the sense that we are looking at the history and the legacy of the American Revolution, but we're very focused on a very specific topic, which is the role of universities in democracies. And 2026 is to signal that this is as much about the future of that relationship as it is about the past. And basically, the initiative is designed to address a very wide range of different publics, the campus, the students, but also our alumni group, the broader public. We're trying to reach the local community, the national community, and the international community for that reason. So the programming that we're sponsoring runs from more academic stuff like conferences and symposia to conversations with high visibility individuals, some from the sort of arts and entertainment world, to more academic talks by former Supreme Court justices and others. And we're trying to steer a very broad-based initiative that really focuses on what do universities contribute to democratic societies.
Can I just add
of course.
One thing there, Mark, which is that there are lots of organizations, including governments at every level from local to national, that are thinking about marking the 250th anniversary of American independence. But the university here, Brown, has an opportunity to do something different. That is, Rhode Island 250 is a fantastic state initiative led by the Secretary of State's office, focusing on Rhode Island's role in the American Revolution. The university, though, and Brown is really distinctive among universities across the country in taking up this challenge, thinking about the relationship between higher education and democracy. And to be clear, this was an initiative that was designed over 2 years ago. It is not meant to answer the immediate moment. But we always knew it would land in a moment. We just didn't know what kind of moment it would be.
And that is exactly why I wanted to have this conversation on this podcast. So we usually do economics and finance and stuff like this, but it's that moment, right? And what I think is very interesting about what this project is attempting to do, and particularly the relationship to democracy, dovetails in with the volatility of the moment. And here's what I mean by this. In normal times, this would not at all be a controversial affair, but we're not in normal times. The university as an institution is under attack from its own state, whether it's policing what can be taught in the name of free speech or defunding research that's never been controversial, we really are in uncharted waters. Behind this assault is a critique of the university itself, especially the elite research university, that it is somehow out of touch with public opinion, out of step with the needs of the country, and out of runway to keep the system of privileged funding that it has relied upon going and going and going. We have, in the eyes of some, become hedge funds that run universities for tax purposes. And these narratives tend to have deep public traction. Almost the majority of voters think that college is not worth it, and almost all of them think it's too expensive. How can we respond to those criticisms? Because obviously, I don't think that's quite right. You don't think this is quite right.
No.
But if we're going to say, hey, look at us, you know, we're a huge part of this, we're an enormous part of this country, how do we basically change and challenge that narrative?
Yeah. Well, let me just start by saying two kind of context setting points. I'm a historian, so I'm always going to want to like pull back and look at the broader historical context. And I think the premise of your question is that there is this relatively, you said normal times, unproblematic relationship between higher education or constant relationship between higher education and, let us just say, the federal government for purposes of being quick about it. But that's not necessarily true. That is, there is a historical context to how the relationship between the government and higher education has developed. Since the mid-20th century, it's been a funding one, increasingly a funding one that's focused on the STEM disciplines. We'll just be shorthand there as well. So first of all, it's not the case that there is a normal and that now we're in an abnormal situation. Things have been complicated for a long time. I would point in particular to the defunding of state universities starting in the 1980s as precipitating part of this current crisis that we're in. It's really multifaceted. It's not just about universities, and it has a long, long history. And the second thing I would say is that the university doesn't exist. That is, higher education is a really complex industry. It's a really multifaceted landscape. Most institutions of higher education are not the kinds that we are sitting in. There are 8 Ivies, there are 13 in the Ivy Plus, and there are maybe 130 R1 or research intensive universities among the thousands of 2 and 4 year colleges across the country. Most adult Americans have some experience of higher education, some college. And, you know, so when we lump all of this together and we say, what about the university? I think we are often mistakenly talking about institutions like Brown, when for most Americans, it's not institutions like Brown. It's their local community colleges or their regional comprehensive universities. So those are just two context setting things that I'd like to start us off with.
One thing just to add to that, Mark, that you may be able to comment on from your perspective a little bit is that it seems to me that the American university model that, as Karen points out, was really an exception that started after the Second World War in a partnership between the federal government and universities, both on the education side with the GI Bill and on the massive investment in science during the Cold War and in the 1960s. You know, it seems to me that the model that was developed during those long 1960s was very much the envy of the world and a model that many nations tried to imitate and are still trying to imitate. And so it seems to me that although we can certainly expect the criticism to continue, it can't be a question for the university of simply withdrawing from this partnership, and it can't be from the federal government side either. But clearly there are some stresses here that can't be denied, right? Mm-hmm. And as you point out, one of the main ones is, of course, the cost of higher education in the United States, which has continued to skyrocket. The wealthier universities have found ways to provide financial aid to blunt that for some of the students who can't afford to pay full tuition. But that, as Karen points out, is only a small part of a much larger system. And it's just undeniable if we're looking at that Gallup poll that you referred to a minute ago, that cost is one of the real drivers of a lack of trust in the university that in the last 10 years has really skyrocketed, that poll suggests, right?
And those costs have increased, you know, much faster than the rate of inflation, faster than the rate of growth in wages. So you understand why people are a little bit suspect as to where this is going. I mean, my own personal thing on this is, without much evidence whatsoever, I think the subjective feeling comes from the fact that there's a bloat There's this bureaucracy that's there now. But what people don't realize about this is a huge part of this is a federal mandate. When you get that money, the strings that come with the money means that you need to employ people to make sure that the money's processed in a certain way, that certain standards are maintained, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's not as if they just give us a check and then we hire our mates, right? That's not what happens. The second point I would want to put into the conversation is this one. In finance, there's actually something that the old people in finance, basically my generation, call the Chomsky trade. And the Chomsky trade was actually after Noam Chomsky, because Noam Chomsky in an interview in the 80s said, if you want to make money 20 years from now, just look at what the federal government did 20 years ago. So if you go back to the 60s, right, you got transistors that becomes the digital revolution. You go to the 1970s, you get the beginning of biotech. You go to the 1980s, you get the beginnings of supercomputers, right? And you just go 20 years forward, and this is what this is. So when we marvel at the consumer products that come out of this game at the end of it, for example, the iPhone, it's a great example from Mariana Mazzucato that every single key technology in the iPhone was made with public funding. Steve was a genius who put it in a shiny box with rounded corners, right? That's why we all fell for it and had the foresight to do it. But all those technologies were publicly funded. So if we're now in a situation of, well, this is just bloat, let's just cut all this. There's no next iPhone. There's no next Apple. That's actually what's at stake in this.
Well, I mean, I love the way you phrase that as really a question about investment. Investment, as people in your discipline know, it's really hard to think long term. And that's what we're asking people to do. I think one thing that happens with higher education is that we get tangled in the question of how is higher education valuable for the individual versus how is higher education a collective good? How is it useful and how is it actually a civic good? And there are kind of two pieces to that too. But let's go back to the question of how is it an individual good? We still show that people who go to college, even people who have some college, have better career outcomes, including better incomes, than people without. And that is, you know, the Department of Education looking at that. And that's the Gates Foundation. This is not my area of expertise. And obviously here at Brown, we have people who look at these things, you know, and who are real experts in this. But nonetheless, even non-experts can see that pattern. Is true that there is an individual outcome here that's better if you have even some college, not even college graduation. But then there is the collective good, and that you can break down into, as you're saying, like the collective good. I don't know, do we still feel that the iPhone is a collective good?
But, you know, the collective hazard.
Right, exactly. The collective good of things like technology, or certainly advances in healthcare. Mm-hmm. But then there is also like this collective civic good of having a more highly educated population.
Yeah.
That seems like worth talking about too.
Mm-hmm. Do we really want to go against the grain there? Kevin, what you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I was just going to jump in. And I think in addition to linking up with what you both said, is that there's a connection between a democratic society and the research and development that's done as it's funded by the federal government in universities, which is, as you point out, Mark, have to be responsive to certain norms of ethics about how that money is spent. That will not be the case if the research and development becomes privatized through Silicon Valley moguls like Elon Musk and the others, which I think looks to be what they're after, to be the replacement for the research and development arm. And why do we need NASA if we have SpaceX?
Right, you know, exactly. So let's get into that for a minute and then sort of pivot back more to 2026. The very first Road Center podcast was with the investor and economist, Bill Janeway. And Bill was at Warburg Pincus back in the 80s and basically was very successful in that space. And he describes in a book that he did a few years ago the entire sort of venture capital industry as being a partner in a three-card game with the universities, the VC industry, and then the private sector writ large that takes ideas to scale, right? And that's basically it. So Kevin just alluded to something that I think is probably the case as well, that you've got a bunch of tech firms, and this is just my hypothesis on this one to echo Kevin, that may be a little bit over-indexed on AI investment, may have caught up in a big arms race that's probably not going to pay off the way they think. And wouldn't it be nice if you could find a nice guaranteed funding stream called all the research money the universities go to? Now, I can imagine that sort of Palantir can spin off drones. I can imagine that Andreessen can fund some pretty crazy firms if they got that money and take even riskier bets. I'm not sure what Elon would do beyond more rockets, but they don't do biotech. Mm. They don't do health. They don't do public health. So what's at stake if we go down that road?
Well, the other thing is that universities, it's not just a three-card game. It's that universities have been a relatively economically effective and efficient way to get that kind of research outcome. That is, we briefly alluded to this by, you know, you talked about the canard of administrative bloat at universities, where in fact there's a lot of increased accountability measures that have to do with precisely federal funding. So let's pretend that all of those accountability measures are off the table. But universities have still provided research at relatively low cost because research is part of the core mission of universities. It's about creating and sharing knowledge. That is not the mission of industry. The mission of industry is to serve its shareholders right now. You want to talk about a complicated card game. That is definitely one. But just to go back to the investment point, the research that universities does is also long-term research. It's investing for the long term. We only have iPhones now because of investments that were made not just 20 years ago, but 40 years ago. So it's a really long game. And while plenty of industrial players used to have labs, not so many do anymore.
Yeah.
I don't think they're prepared to step into this space.
Yeah, and there's obviously built-in cost sharing between the universities and the government if the private sector replaces the universities as research and development. Even if you assume that we're going to have less than 60% overhead covered by federal grants, the other 40 is still covered by the university, right?
And also in those overhead charges, essentially you would just they don't disappear, right? The cost of keeping the lab warm, the cost of keeping the animals alive, whatever it happens to be, they don't go away. So you would simply turn around and put them in upfront costs. They would become part of the grant. And it would still be more cost effective than actually going through the private sector. This is a standard investment problem in a way, because what you've got is, what's the optimal institution to host a particular type of investment? So if you've got a 3-month horizon, probably not a university. Right. If you've got a 1-year horizon, maybe it's a university. If you've got a 5 or 10 year or 20 year horizon, it's absolutely a university, because there just aren't many institutions like that.
Mm. So let me come back to your initial question about how we reverse the trend, which seems clear now, of distrust toward the university. We've already talked about the cost of students to attend in the United States. But there's also, I think, been a deficit in terms of the university's communication to the general public of what we actually do. All of the things that we're now talking about are not things that have been deliberately communicated from the universities to the general public. Certainly in scientific research, there's always impact statements that are part of federal grants. But those are just going back to the agencies and explaining the social impact of some kind of scientific research. I think it's clear that we need to do much more in the university to provide infrastructure within the university to the people who work in universities, like faculty, to undertake much more effective communication. And fortunately, with the new technologies that we have, it's quite possible to do this. But I don't think we've had a deliberate effort from the universities themselves to try to emphasize investing in infrastructure to do that and make it possible for faculty to engage the public more broadly. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying to do around this initiative, which is take it as an opportunity for us to try to open up channels of communication.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's interesting because I think when we started this initiative, we were thinking about the broader public and however one defines that, whether it's our campus, whether it's our, you know, broader Brown community, whether it's here in Providence, the world, whatever. But actually, I think there's a real opportunity and even an imperative now for us to have conversations on campus about what we're about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is it that we actually do have in common? And sometimes, you know, we have kind of over-described those divisions between STEM and HSS, let's say, or between kind of, we think, high research cost and low research cost disciplines, which I can tell you as a historian, we get grumpy about that. it's a lot of energy cost, let's just say, to produce high quality historical research. But there's a real opportunity for us to talk more to one another in a deep way about the context for our work, about the values we share, the mission we share, and how we go about doing our work. And I honestly think that would be enormously valuable too.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to 2026 and the notion of democracy. We live in increasingly polarized times where democracy itself is not trusted by increasingly large slices of the population. We are in a quasi-authoritarian moment, according to some. How can the university, if not change that, show people that there's a different way that democracy can function and that it means something more than just polarization and noise?
I always think that as an organization, whatever your organization is, the thing you do, you should do with integrity. You should do because it's core to your mission and it's core to your capacity and your expertise. And the thing that we do in a university is we generate and share knowledge. And I think that's what we ought to be about doing. So I'm not sure that doing anything different substantially serves us better. I don't think we need to turn ourselves into something that we're not. But I do think that clearer articulation, beginning in and among ourselves about what are our values and what is our purpose, and being clear about that, and recognizing that it is as true for me as a historian as it is for you as an economist, and Kevin as a literary scholar, and all of our colleagues as data scientists or whatever, that we share a common purpose, we are better able to communicate that to the public at large.
Yeah, I think Karen's point about the collectivity of university is really important. That's what the word university means. And I think a little bit of history here, maybe on Karen's turf. It's a little bit hard to
deny.
I'll
stop you, don't worry.
It's a little bit hard to deny that there wasn't something like the democratization of higher education in the 1960s in the United States. Right. All you have to do is look at the statistics, and they're really dramatic. So there was a huge growth in higher ed, which meant a huge growth not only in research, but also in education, including liberal arts education in the 1960s was really unprecedented. I mean, the American university before that time was not a democratized institution. It was very much an elite institution. And so, you know, I think the word democracy has some meaning in that context. Now, there were things happening in the 1960s that gave a certain inflection to that process, right? Let's say, for example, the Vietnam War and the distrust that sowed in the public with images on television every week of what was happening in Southeast Asia. The civil rights movement was also happening in the 1960s. And part of the democratization of the university was the way in which it absorbed also these things that were happening. And very much the discourse that we're seeing now aimed against the university also has its origins in this period. And, you know, going back to the early 1970s, and I think, you know, the democratization came with what is also undeniably a diversification of the university. And this led to some tensions, which I think have now come home to roost, so to speak. So we're hearing things now that really have their origins in the 1960s that we need to, I think, recognize and pay attention a little bit more to that history.
Got any good examples of that? I mean, any particular figures that spring to mind from this period that were making those noises now and that we're hearing
well,
now?
Well, so I think the obvious thing was the Powell memo from 1971, which, you know, was addressed to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And it was about the fact that the university was taking over a space that private industry and free enterprise was supposed to occupy. And that's where I see the connection between the Silicon Valley people who are now interested in usurping some of the university's role. But yeah, please, Karen, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say that it is a little odd, though, right, that there are these potent critiques of higher education, that universities are too elite, when in fact what we know is universities have become much more diverse spaces and places of much greater opportunity for more people over time. So there's no one story, there's no one origin moment, mm-hmm. and there is no one narrative here. There's a lot of conflicting stuff that's going on, and it's some of that is just beyond the university itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it is significant that what Kevin points out, that we have been here before. I mean, you started mm-hmm. with this. It's not always been an uncontested relationship. I mean, I vaguely remember Ronald Reagan going off on the universities.
Yeah,
oh,
sure.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
There's
yeah.
a
Department
long
of Education
history.
Under Reagan.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. For
way.
A long time,
yeah.
right?
The 40s.
So in a way, it's not unprecedented. It's just a sort of like ramping it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's landing in a different moment. It's different,
right.
a different media moment. It's a different political moment.
But it's also a moment, if you go back to the 60s and then the early 70s, when the universities, in a sense, embraced the vibrant democracy of the street and the social movements, that's when they got slapped. And in a sense, post 2020, you know, there's a bit of a reflection of that going on as well. There's a very similar echo, I think, in that moment.
I never forget that I arrived to do my PhD on a campus that only started accepting women as undergraduates not even 15 years earlier.
Right.
So, you know, the idea to the critique of universities is these like crazy liberal hotbeds. It's like, have you ever been on a campus?
I know.
Universities are slow moving places. They're fairly conservative institutions in all kinds of ways. Yes, there are some quite liberal people, but there are also plenty of quite conservative people, and they're institutions that have been slow to change, as demonstrated by my PhD granting institution.
I'll give you another example from where I'm from Scotland. There are two major universities in Glasgow. There's now three. And I won't mention which one this is, but the students' union for one of them admitted, I think it was, if I get this right now, women, I think, in 1980, but Catholics later than that. So, yeah, rather conservative institutions and peculiar in some ways. All right, let's think about students, okay? So in this regard, how can or should students think about the role in a university with all of this going on, right? What are some of the things we know now about how students understand higher education, their experience in it, and how does that sort of feed into the democratic purpose of the university?
Well, so Kevin alluded to some of the people that we've had on campus. One of our public launch events in January was with Brown alum Dovie Diggs, the fantastic, you know, Broadway star, actor, producer, rapper, amazing guy. I loved listening to him talk to students.
Right.
Honest, I'm going to get to your question here.
That's fine.
but he was so great. Students were coming to him to talk about concerns they had about, in fact, how the university is too slow moving, too conservative, whatever. They wanted some rapid action change. And he was so great. He said, look, here's the thing. He's a little older than they are now. And he said, you know, when you get to be my age, you start to appreciate that there are some slow moving institutions that nonetheless have the right idea. They may not move as quickly as you like, but sometimes that's a good thing because they hold on to their values and they consider their progress and their direction. And I thought that was so useful. Students are amazing. They're like lightning in a bottle, but they are in the sense that they're here and they're gone,
yes.
Right? And then there's the next generation of students. And they're so vibrant and energetic, but their experience of college is this one moment. So I think that college can be intense and great for them. But when you're on the other side of it, when you're inside the slow-moving ship, you see them as a kind of source of energy and inspiration, but you don't want to redirect the entire ship.
Yeah, and I think we want to be very careful, those of us who work in the university and especially who teach students, to find opportunities to convey to the students why the distrust of the university that's all around them, in their families, in their communities, should not prevent them from getting the kind of liberal education that will contribute to a democratic society in the long run. And I think we're seeing that our students are facing a lot of pressure right now. But I don't think it has to be a choice between preparing yourself to become employed after you've finished your degree and also getting a broad-based liberal arts education at the same time. And I think that's what we have to try to highlight the linkage between these two things over the course of a lifetime. Again, going back to the point Karen made about the slowness of things, we're preparing students during the 4 years that they're here for a lifetime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My favorite example of this is there was a survey a few years ago of the survivability of hedge funds, because they all blow up, right? Very few of them last 20 years. They're dinosaurs in the industry. Most of them are sort of like 18 months to like 2 years, 5 years done, right? And they looked at the college majors of the people who ran hedge funds. And if you did applied math, econ, all that sort of stuff, you were most likely to blow up, right? Guess which major had the longevity? History. It was historians. Basically, they've seen it before. When it came down the turnpike, they weren't blindsided by it.
Wow. Well, you know, I always say that it is really tough to see the arguments about what students should major in and what's practical and what's not practical when the statistical analysis shows us that, in fact, humanities majors do incredibly well in terms of their careers. And they do well in their careers in all kinds of different places, which your example just beautifully illustrated. And I would just call out the Humanities Indicators Project of the American Academy for Arts and Sciences, which has a state-by-state breakdown of employment opportunities by college major. Mm-hmm. And that's really great, great data.
Let's hope they don't get canceled.
Well, I remember,
private organization.
I remember I gave a talk in New York a few years back, maybe 10 years ago. And before it was called AI, it was called big data. It was the same thing, and more or less. And this was also when parents had this great idea that their children shouldn't actually have any fun or friends. They should all learn coding, right? And we had a conversation about this, and I said, you realize this is the one thing that's most likely to be automated. So they're not developing any social or intellectual skills or friends or whatever. You're literally teaching them to be redundant. And the room went completely silent. I said, so how many of you are actually doing this? There must have been 200 people in the room. I'd say about 80 people raised their hands. And I was like, please stop. Stop now. This is not what education is.
Yeah. And part of what you're doing is you're educating people about what education is.
Yes.
Right? And that's what I mean about, like, let's stay core to our mission and our expertise and our capacity. Let's be what we are, because what we are is a place that creates and shares knowledge in the public interest. That's what we do in all of our disciplines across all of our domains here. And that's why you asked us at the beginning, how does this connect to democracy? And you don't get that kind of arrangement in higher education in anything but a liberal democracy.
Okay, let's close it out with the discussion of the fun stuff. You've got a program. You're bringing people to campus. Like, sell me. Sell me this whole thing. Tell me what I'm going. I need to block out my diary months in advance. So I need to know who's coming, what's hot. Give me the whole thing.
Well, we can't do that in part because we have some holds on high-profile people who they don't always let you say
that.
Things. What I will say, though, is that there have been some really fantastically rewarding programs that we started this year, started them as pilots, and that will amplify and build into next year. So I'm just going to call out our wonderful postdoc coordinator, Rebecca Graham, who helped run Brown 2026 Reads, which was a project to distribute books through the dean of the college. Thank you, Rashid, who's also on our steering committee, to distribute books and then match the authors with small groups of students for discussion. We're going to ramp that up and do that in a bigger way in this coming year. And that's amazing because, as you know, it's fantastic to get, you know, hundreds of people in a room watching David Diggs. That's incredible. And John Batiste, and yeah, we've had some really great stuff, and there will be more. That's intense, but what's really intense is when you have a group of 15 students who've read the same book and who want to talk about it. That's great energy, too.
Kevin?
Yeah, and we've also been partnering with a lot of departments and centers and institutes at Brown. One example of that is your umbrella institute, the Watson Institute, partnered with us on an event with former Justice Breyer. It was a great event for us, and the things that we're sponsoring run the gamut, really, from things that will be high visibility and popular. Karen talked about David Diggs. We're going to have Ken Burns here in the fall. He's launching a new film, I think, called The American Revolution.
Indeed, yes.
And he will be here to present his new documentary, and there's some public events that will be happening with him around Family Weekend in October. And then we're doing more academic things around specific disciplines. The History Department is thinking about an event in the spring on the history of the research university, for example.
The rise and question mark of the research university.
And I have some colleagues in American literature here at Brown who are organizing a conference this fall called Fictions of the American Revolution. So those are more academically oriented work, but it's helping us convene the conversation within the university as well that Karen was talking about before.
Karen and Kevin, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Dan Richards. I'm Mark Blythe. You can listen to more conversations like this by subscribing to the Road Centre podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Road Centre podcast. Thanks.